Yes, again, here you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chair.
Good morning. I've got a problem with my Wi-Fi.
Okay, Chairperson.
Let's see, how many people are in the platform already?
Right now we have got about 67 participants, Chair.
67 means because members of the neglect committees are still attending the NCOP.
That is correct, Chair.
So for now, we have got the Standing Committee on Finance only, and appropriation.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll have to start because, Honorable Karim has indicated to me that they have got a session this morning. They will join us late. I suspect that Honorable Buthelezi is still busy dealing with the funeral arrangements of his sister.
It's true.
Is Honorable Kaiser here? Yes,
I'm around, Chair. Good morning.
Moreover, you are in America. That bridge is in Mississippi. It's not on the Mississippi River.
Jabula Bona.
Who call now? Who Abraham? Who comrade? Not one. No, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. So, can we start? Oh, yes.
Yes, Chairperson, you can start your meeting, Chair.
Okay.
Honorable Abrams is just...
Oh. Hey, no, please.
Morning, sir. Let me rename quickly,
sir.
And it's still going to take time because only last week they told me to come and give them the iCloud pin because they can't work with it because of this, and I was not able to go there because I was traveling to Cape Town.
Oh,
so it's gonna take time. I haven't been there yet. Let's go tomorrow.
Okay, no problem.
But I've renamed my gadget now. Thank you, sir.
Okay, I can see here on the platform. Welcome, honorable members of the Standing Committee on Finance and Standing Committee Appropriations. You are all welcome to this joint meeting to get a briefing from the PPO and the FFC. And the meeting is officially open. Let's move to item two. Apologies, Lubabalo and Tebu.
Thank you, Chairperson. On behalf of the Select Committee on Appropriations, Chairperson, I would like to register the apology of members, Chair. They are still in the house sitting, but as soon as the house sitting adjourns, they will join this meeting, Chairperson. Also, the Chairperson, Honorable Masango, invited the Provincial Portfolio Committee Chairpersons and their committees. Some have submitted apologies, provinces like Free State, Northwest, Mpumalanga, and Northern Cape, I think so, but I'm not sure because I saw a colleague from Northern Cape here. Others have joined. I saw Wuche person from the Cape. Others, I have not recognized others because we are accepting, a lot of us are in terms of accepting the participants here. But I believe they will participate in the meeting and then you will recognize them at that time. Thanks.
Okay. Sister Teboho, are there apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson. No, sir,
I didn't receive any apologies from the Standing Committee on Finance.
Okay.
Chairperson, on behalf of the Standing Committee on Appropriations, I received apologies from Mr. Butelezi and Mr. Matafa. Mr. Mare indicated that he needs to leave the meeting by 5 to 11. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Imam, I see you raising your hand.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Good day to you all. I am multitasking, Chair. I'm on the Police Committee and on the Standing Committee on Appropriation at the same time. So please bear with me. Thank you very much.
Honorable Zambwini.
Morning, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. I'll also have to leave early because I'm attending the committee on women in the presidency committee today. Thank you.
Welcome, Natasha.
Chairperson.
Thank you,
sir. Yes, it's Honorable Matafa. I just wanted to put on record. I have tabled my apology with Darren because my connection is unstable and it keeps on kicking me out of the meeting. For now, I am in the meeting. However, should I disappear, just for the information for the Chairperson, it's not out of my own volition. It's the network that is failing me in that process. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Matafa. Honorable Govenda, I see you raising the hand, the platform.
Thanks, Chairperson. I will have to leave at 10 because we have our State of the Province debate, which commences at 10. And I may come in later if this meeting is still on.
Okay, Honorable Govenda. Bishop Madlopa, how are you? I see you raising your hand here on the platform.
Yes, Chairperson, how are you?
Good day, Bishop.
Giddy greetings to all the colleagues. Also, I want to put my apology forward. At 10 o'clock, we are having a debate on this topic. Maybe I will come.
Sit down.
Hey, my brother, I'm at home now, you know. That's nothing, you know, it's nice to be at home, brother.
We're missing your prayers, yeah. There's nobody to pray for us.
I also miss you. Oh,
yeah. Okay. Good to hear from you, Bishop Madlopa.
Hey, I miss you in all the way.
Long time.
Okay.
Those are the apologies. Welcome, colleagues from provinces. We'll have to move straight to presentation before we lose colleagues, more especially those who are rushing to stop a debate. And then in case they finish earlier, they will have to come back and join us. Let's invite PBO, Dr. Judges and your team. Can you take over and make your presentation? Honorable Kaiso, can I request you to chair in the meantime? I just have to quickly attend to something here in the house. But for now, let's invite Dr. Janshis. Are you there, Comrade Kais?
Yes, I'm here, Chair.
Yeah, can you sharing the session on PBO presentation?
Thank you so much, Chair. Good morning, panel members. Good morning, colleagues. I just want to ask my colleagues to slide us. Thank you so much for the opportunity to brief these committees, joint committees on the budget. I'm waiting for my colleagues to apply to our presentation. Yes. thank you so much. Our position outline, we look at the policies, we look at policy priorities, the funding related to those policy spending, but also provide a brief on current situation and implication for fiscal framework and consumer liabilities and debt, and some of the developments around tax proposals and some of the revenue proposals today. Next slide. Rashad, next slide. Thank you. I think this is just a normal slide we have introduction. Just to alert honorable members and chairperson that we have sent out invitation today, but I think we just updated it as well overnight just to make more accessible. So some of the technologies that were separately updated implementation as well. The PPO was established in terms of the Money Bills Act to precisely support these finance and inclusion committees in processing the money bills and budgets. So this is our role that we're doing in this regard. In this presentation, we'll provide analysis of the budgets as presented to look at fiscal framework. Is something wrong with the chat?
Honorable Chair, sorry for interruption. Honorable Chair.
Yes, Honorable Ryder.
Kutsia speaking from the Eastern Cape.
Oh, okay.
There's something wrong with the presenter's gadget because there's a lot of echo and we can hardly hear him. I don't know if it's only my experience or that other also experience the same problem.
No, thank you're right. Thank you. Dr. Jantjies, can't you perhaps enlarge and also attend to the volume or voice or the, because like the members get strained now to hear, and also a bit of, you know, enlarging your screen.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much. Just go back to the previous slide, please, before I kick Dr. Olan. Can you hear me, Chairperson, now?
Yes, yes, I can hear you.
Thank you, Rashad. Just go to your slides once more, just before I give, to emphasize the importance of this presentation. Take the slide, please. I apologize for the previous slides. Yeah, previous slides.
Is it possible that Global Bolu can take over?
Yes, no, that's fine. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much. You're fine. Yes. The presentation provides analysis of the budget, including summary of the BNP there, but also the approaching bill. We'll do the division of revenue discussion later in the month. But I think in the main, the discussion, if our analysis looks at how the budget proposals could possibly affect government service delivery, economic recovery, social economic issues, but also how are we able to realize our fiscal objectives within the budget proposal that I set out. In the main, the budget proposal reduces the debt to GDP levels and provide support for COVID-19, but also try to improve competitiveness expenditure. So this is some of the issues we're looking at in the initial. I'll give to Dr. Lange to clear so a candidate what.
Next slide. Good morning, honourable members and chairperson and guests. I will take you through the policy priority and funding section. So, members, in line with the State of the Nation address, the 2021 budget is framed by objectives to extend temporary support in response to COVID-19, to promote economic recovery, and also to return the public finances to a sustainable position. Next slide. So despite the reduction of 8.8 billion from the National Revenue Fund in 2021-22 to the Health Budget Function Group, the government reprioritized 1.3 billion for vaccine purchases, and an additional estimated 9 billion could be drawn from the contingency reserve to defeat the coronavirus. With regards to the accelerating economic recovery, government will support the economic recovery by extending short-term economic support and undertaking reforms to lower the cost of doing business and stabilize public finances. In terms of operational Bulandlela, that focuses on a subset of key reforms, was only initiated to focus on implementing high impact reforms. So the net change to the economic development budget function in this 2021-22 budget is -8.3 billion. Next slide. With regards to the creation of sustainable jobs and a drive towards inclusive growth, an amount of 12.6 billion was made available for public employment programs during the 2020 adjustments budget. And despite a reduction of 8.3 billion in 2021-22, the Economic Development Function Group reprioritized 11 billion for the Presidential Youth Employment Initiative. Just to note, members, although energy security has not been prioritized for 2021-22, the budget provides for 32.6 billion in the general public service budget function group in terms of energy security. To fight corruption and strengthen the state, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development reprioritized 1.8 billion to improve business processes and to support law enforcement agents in the fight against crime and corruption. Next slide. So members, this is just the detail of what I've just also indicated in the previous slide. So some of the detail with regards to the reprioritization towards the presidential priorities, you will see in terms of the first, the health function budget group, there was a provincial equitable share reduction of 18.1 billion. And some of this money has been, or most of the money has been reprioritized towards COVID-19 vaccine programs. In the economic development function group, the net change in that group was -8.3 billion, and you will see some of the reprioritized funds went to the South African Civil Aviation Authority, 277.6 million, and the Road Traffic Infringement Agency. In terms of the General Public Service Function Group, there was a net change to the function baseline of 32.6 billion rand. Some of the funds that have been reprioritized from provincial departments, provincial equitable share, the increases went to Land and Agricultural Development Bank, the New Development Bank, Development Bank of South Africa, the Auditor General, South African Revenue Services, and payments for financial assets to Eskom to purchase its equity is 31.7 billion rand. Next slide. This is a diagram that we show every year to illustrate the changes in the proportion of the budget per budget function group. So you will see in 2021, there was a reduction in the learning and culture group to 21.3% of the total budget, but that increases again over the medium term to reach 23.7% of the total budget. Then in terms of health, in the current financial or the new financial year 2021-22, you can see there is a slight increase of to 14.3% from a 13.6%. In terms of social development, we all know that all the reprioritization went to social development, and there was a spike in the 2020 financial year, the red bar, and we spent 22.7% of our budget on social development in the 2020 financial year. The next one that we can just look at is the general public service. In 2020, 3.4% of the budget were spend or estimated to be spent on public general public service, and that increases to 3.9% in the 2021-22 financial year, and it's basically staying stable over the medium term. Next slide. So members, with this table, we just want to illustrate mainly to show you that the 2021-22 estimates were mainly reversed in the current financial year. So if we take Parliament as an example, Parliament's main budget was reduced by 7.5% in the adjusted budget from the main budget in 2020-21. Now in the 21-22 budget, it has increased by 6.4%, which shows that almost the entire reduction in 2020 has been given back, but not all of it. So if you calculate the change from the main 2020 allocation to the new 2021-22 allocation, there's a decrease of 1.7%. You can go through all the others on your own time. Next slide. Just in terms of spending priorities for economic classification, you can see the big drive in terms of compensation of employees in 2020-21. We've only spent or estimated to spend 31% of the budget on compensation. It increases to 32.4% in 21-22, and then it decreases again to 31.5% over the medium term. The next one that we can just allude you to is transfers and subsidies. Again, in 2020-21, there was a spike, and we spent 36.1% of our budget on transfers and subsidies, which is mainly due to the transfers to households on the social grants. Next slide. So, members, just to get a better understanding of the strategy of the reduction in the wage bill, the PBO considered the personnel numbers on a national level. So some of the findings worth noting are that the average reduction in personnel numbers over the medium term is 2.1%, and the average increase per unit cost over the medium term is 2.4%. The number of funded posts are estimated to amount to 408,000. In the 2021 financial year. And just also to mention that there are 4,231 positions in addition to the approved number of positions on a national level. The elimination of this practice could actually reduce staff numbers by 1% if we get rid of all the additional positions. With regards to provinces, the budget information shows an annual average growth in COE, in basic education, of 0.8% and health only 0.9%. If the number of education and health service workers are to remain stable, these rates should be applied only to administration and frontline workers. With regards to the sustainability of the mass public employment program, that was initiated, it was noted that the Department of Social Development created more than 2,000 jobs in 2020-21, which just disappeared in the numbers in the 2021-22 financial year. Next slide. Just in terms of some of the structural reforms mentioned before, with regards to the macro structure, national boats transfer almost 70% of their budget to other institutions. The incorporation of the smaller institutions as programs in departments could have a major impact on staff numbers, and merging other smaller departments with departments providing similar function groups not just result in a possible saving of 4.3 billion, but also reduce duplication in service delivery. Secondly, the composition of expenditure should improve effective and efficient service delivery. The trade-off between compensation of employees and consultants should be prevented and monitored, and trade-offs between compensation and transfer should be also considered. Next slide. So, 30 members, the mechanisms for the budget process are still not implemented as planned. It is observed that the Government Technical Advisory Centre will be responsible for the reviews, or we assume that the additional 4.1 million is for that purpose. But other reports are also available. When you look at the outputs of several national departments, they basically produce monitoring and evaluation reports on service delivery on a quarterly basis, which can be very useful in terms of reviewing the budget in the budget process and to review allocations. Parliament also produces BRO reports, the DPME produces evaluations, and the National Treasury regularly issue guidelines, frameworks, instructions. but it is also noted that some of these guidelines, frameworks and instructions are not implemented. So if these tools are not useful or ignored, the mechanism should be reviewed. The Parliamentary Budget Office also found that performance information on public entities is not available on the systems provided by government for reporting, and performance information on conditional grants are not available on a quarterly basis. The Estimates of National Expenditure also provides a very useful selection of performance indicators per department and for public entities. Performance on these indicators should be very useful if it's been included in the quarterly expenditure reports presented to Parliament to assist Parliament and the public basically to monitor the implementation of the budget. But at this stage, the quarterly performance reporting are just on expenditure. Thank you, members. Then I'll hand over to Dr. Siraj Mohammed.
Okay, good morning, members, honourable members, good morning, everybody in the meeting. But if I stay on this slide for about 30 seconds while doing the introduction. The first thing I want to point out is that the section just presented presents the table presents the numbers in nominal terms. So it doesn't take into account inflation, and that's usual in accounting and budgeting. In the economic section and economic analysis we do, we actually convert those numbers to real numbers. And you can only really, within economic analysis, compare numbers over years by taking into account the purchasing power of money that year. So basically looking at the impact of inflation. So that's the one important thing. The other thing is sort of as an introduction I want to say is that, you know, over the past few years, we've asked how much longer governments will pursue fiscal consolidation. Last year at the MTBPS, I explained that the economic idea behind fiscal consolidation was one that was coined quite soon after the global financial crisis when countries were implementing a fiscal stimulus, and it argued for contractionary expansion. And the idea of contractionary expansion was basically that government should cut spending and improve and try and reduce its levels of debt, even though they realized that these spending cuts would have a negative impact on growth and economic performance. But they argued that as business, private sector and businesses saw improvements in the government's budget and lower debt, the business confidence would increase and you would then get more investment and business activity. And this would also, and that's why it's called contraction expansion. Now, as we said last year, this idea behind fiscal consolidation has been shown to be theoretically wrong and empirically disproven. So the question is, how much longer are we going to follow this idea of contraction expansion and implement fiscal consolidation? How much longer are we going to watch, our debt levels increase, business confidence decrease, unemployment rates increase? I think that's an important question that comes up in this section of the presentation. The other point is that a lot of what is being offered in the budget review of 2021 is about supply side measures that aren't really on budget. There isn't a budgetary stimulus to the economy or support to poor households in really hard times. It points to structural reforms, and a lot of it depends on the private sector coming to the party. So we see in real terms very real reductions in social expenditure, the social grants, etc. Richard, please move on to the next slide, please. So what we're arguing is that the budget does not support growth during the MTF, nor recovery and reconstruction. And to use the words or paraphrase what budget reviews, there's the proposed expenditure reductions of the medium term
does not strike a balance, and these are the words in the budget, where they say they're going to strike a balance between immediate support for the economy and shoring up the country's finances. We argue that isn't happening. A big risk to South Africa's post-pandemic reconstruction is paucity of direct budgetary interventions to grow demand and drive investment, jobs and growth. Key components of government's approach are off-budget. These include structural reforms and a fund to leverage private infrastructure investment. The economy requires both supply side and demand side interventions, and we really worry, as we said in the MTBPS even before the pandemic, that the supply side interventions aren't going to work if we don't have demand side interventions to actually support demand growth and the economy. Despite the successes of Operation Vulindlela, the time frame for implementation of the structural reforms remain uncertain, and response times private sector these reforms may likely after a bit. Uncertainty remains high, and private businesses prefer to keep their assets liquid in financial assets rather than sunk in fixed investment projects for years. And as we have seen even before the pandemic, but even within the pandemic time, surprisingly, financial markets were very profitable during the pandemic, and this continues. And so the returns to the private sector of staying in liquid and in financial markets is quite high at the moment, and is a real challenge to investing making real sector investments, especially in infrastructure where you have long-term money sunk. At the same time, there are more unemployment, poverty, and inequality, which have increased the risk of social and political. Thanks, Rishad. Next slide, please. You're going backwards. Okay, one more forward. Yeah, this one. Thank you. Now, this slide just shows what's happening on the supply side and Operation Vulindlela sort of at the center, focusing on important supply side interventions, and we're not saying that we shouldn't have. We actually think that they are important, and we're glad, as we said, to see the progress made, but worried about the pacing of the progress and whether it's going to actually affect it in the NTF. We're arguing that what's missing is what's on the right, the demand side interventions, and expansionary fiscal and monetary policy that can be used in a mutually reinforcing way with supply side interventions by boosting aggregate demand. Next slide, please. Okay, so as I was saying, we were showing real numbers, and if you look at the top slide, which is comparing nominal public sector investment estimates and the forecast and forecasting the 2021 budget review estimates of these numbers deflated by inflation. So what we're basically doing is we took the National Treasury's numbers in the economic section, which they're proposing is what's going to happen to the expenditure side of to GDP and things like investment, household expenditure, etc. And we're showing sort of what the role of one of the important supply side interventions, which is public sector infrastructure, and this is meant to, with other support, to leverage private sector investment. And what we're showing in the top slide is, if you look at the green bars, that from 2017 to 2019, public sector infrastructure investment actually declined. And if you look at the period over the MTS, we actually see a slight increase from 2021 to 2022, and then sort of not much happening in 2023. So there's not actually enough public sector infrastructure investment going on to get us even back to 2017 level. The second graph shows real investment, gross capital formation as a percentage of GDP, and also real total public sector investment as a percentage of GDP. And again, these are the numbers from the budget review and in Appendix D. So this is basically what they say is going to happen. And if you look at the red bar, which is total public sector investment as a percentage of GDP, we see the contribution of public sector investment will not have very large impact either on real investment or GDP. And remember, these investment numbers, the total investment numbers, which include public and private investment, is also taken from what we argue is a probably very likely an overestimate of investment over the MPF and private investment particularly. Next slide, please, Rishabh. So to show this about overestimate that we think budget review is an overestimate, what we've done here is this slide looks a bit confusing, but what it's showing is the forecast and the estimates in the budget reviews and medium-term budget policy statements since 2018. And the solid lines are actuals. I think there's actually been a mistake with solid and dashes. I think in redoing the slides, we made a mistake. But I'll just get to the quick point also because I'm taking up more time than I should. There was a real decline in investment growth during 2018 of 1.4% and 2019 of 0.9%. The 2018 budget review forecast was much overestimated at 1.9% for 2018 and 3.3% for 2019. And then just to jump to the last bullet point, I don't want to go into what happened during the pandemic with that big dip and then the rebound, to say that we think that the rebound is overestimated, basically. But the budget review 2021 may possibly overestimate investment growth again, as it did previously and over a number of years, by putting it at 3.9% for 2020. Next slide, please. So what we're saying is that the idea that there aren't going to be interventions on the budget and stimulus and help to poor households is a problem, because then you depend on private investment basically to drive GDP growth over the MTF and into the future, and we actually see this as a problem. 2021 budget is focused on reducing expenditure and debt levels rather than providing immediate support to economic growth and adequate support for grants and services to households. The 2021 budget review depends on private investment to drive growth in the MTF, when that growth actually requires greater wealth and purchasing power of poor households. Excuse me. The MTF GDP growth forecast in the 2021 budget review, and these are using the budget review numbers, not our forecast or estimates or anybody else's. So this is what's coming out of National Treasury and budget review numbers, which shows that the growth forecasts are almost totally dependent on real growth in household consumption. So if you look at the first set of bars that show GDP, real growth in GDP, and you look at what's happening with household consumption, you'll see in the MTF from the red bar, they're going upwards in both. If you look at government consumption from the red bar, it's actually going downwards. The government consumption is negative contributor to GDP growth in MTF. And then the 2021 budget review forecast for investment growth is probably an overestimate, but if you look at what's happening there, when we look at the numbers and not the percentage changes as in the budget review, you see that it's actually a really, really small compared to the impact of households. So what we're arguing is that real reductions in social expenditure, including social grants, will not only hurt the poor, but constrain growth and government revenue future. Next slide, please. okay, so this slide shows the updated numbers from the Labour Force survey from Stats South Africa. I won't go into it in detail, but I want to stress that there is a very real link between unemployment, poverty, and the economic performance, and especially as we're showing that household expenditure is really important, and more people that are unemployed, the more difficult it will be to get the household consumption to actually perform according to that kind of growth that we saw being projected by the budget review. The numbers we put up, as I said, was the numbers of annual growth in the budget review. So we may actually not get that household consumption. And with the increases in unemployment, there hasn't been a bounce back since the much big bounce back, enough to actually make up for the losses during the pandemic, as was shown in the quarterly labor survey. The second thing is, then there is a link between unemployment and not increasing the social grant and GDP, and that links back to the budget and the amount of money that can be collected in terms of revenue. So there's a direct relationship there as well. Next slide, please, Michelle. So this is actually those two bullet points that I was just saying. If we look at quarter four 2019, there was a net loss of 836,000 jobs in the formal sector employment that was driven by finance, manufacturing, construction, community and social services. Quarter four in the informal sector, 396,000 more net job losses were observed as compared to the fourth quarter of 2019. A large number of people moved from or entered the labor force between the two quarters. The movement, however, was proportionally more for the unemployed than for the employed, which resulted in an increase of 1.7% in the unemployment rate, 32.5%. And the labor force participation rate was higher in quarter 2020 as compared to quarter 3 2020. The rate has declined year on year. The absorption rate increased by 0.7 to 38.2% in the fourth quarter of 2020 compared to the third quarter, but decreased year on year. And I think one of the important things we need to look at is that we're actually seeing unemployment rates very high, and they've been getting higher even before the pandemic. And two is that these numbers, and especially what happened in the pandemic, raised even more alarm bells about the nature and the precariousness that exists within the South African labor market and how that affects people's lives in a very real way. And that it's very easy to put off people, not pay them, unless there's government support for that, and then to rehire them, and not necessarily rehire the same people. So I'm going to end there, and my colleague Rashad will carry on with the next section. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Dr. Janjis?
Chairperson? Hello, Chairperson?
Yes. Have you finished?
We are finishing. Just give us a few minutes, Chairperson. Okay. Yes, thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, honourable members. Given time constraints, I'm going to go rather readily through the next couple of slides. What we have in front of you is a table comparing the changes in the growth outlook. It shows you significant changes from the budget last year, and it compares National Treasury's most recent estimate, that's from this year's budget, to the Reserve Bank and the IMF, and showing you that there's a marginal improvement in the outlook compared to the MTVPS. And this is across the board. This is important because obviously we know that the budget performance is very much linked to the performance of the overall economy. When we say improvement, we mean it's less negative. So the contraction in this last year, so 2020-2021, will be smaller than was previously anticipated in the MTVPS and the special appropriations budget in June last year. What's important to note, and generally when you look at fiscal and economic forecasts, there's a great degree of uncertainty. These are subject to revision, and in the current context of a global pandemic, this uncertainty is radical, and it depends again on the efficacy of the vaccines, the rollout, the impact this will have on global trade, and future waves of the pandemic, both domestically and abroad. What we have in front of you over here, and this is an update from what we presented last week Tuesday to the honorable members, is the revised main budget deficit outlook from the budget, comparing that to what was previously presented. And what we can see is the bright red, so that's the scarlet red in the middle, is the new outlook for the current MTEF. It was significantly improved, improved compared to what was presented in the MTVPS and the SAP, when the growth outlook was expected to be a lot worse. And as we know, and as was noted, and will be noted later on in this presentation, that revenue performance on a year-to-date hasn't been as bad as what was anticipated. And this is seen in the budget balance, as well as some expenditure adjustments. The revision is in line with the orange line, which is in line with the lime green line, which is what the PBO presented last week. So this is in line with what was expected, but it's still quite significant, quite large, and has implications then for borrowing going forward. The next slide following from the budget deficit is debt service costs. This is something we should keep a a keen eye on in considering the ability of the state to continue servicing its debt and rolling over its debt is the amount of revenue raised that is allocated towards debt service costs. Again, the bright red line is what was presented in the budget last week. This is significantly higher than what was presented in the budget last year, obviously given the crisis, but it is an improvement compared to what was expected last year during the MTBPS. Again, that revision is in line with what the PBO presented. That said, though, it is quite significant and notable that around 20-22% of every RAND raised in revenue has been allocated towards debt service costs. The improvement also reflects a marginal positive shift in National Treasury's management of debt with short-term debt issued in the current year, which is noted in the budgetary review. However, this also increases rollover risk that needs to be noted, and also the positive development of tapping into funds from global organizations such as the IMF and the New Development Bank. Lastly, this is the headline figure when we talk about the budget deficit over the medium term as well as the debt stock over the medium term. What is important to note over here is how significantly the revision has changed over time to the estimates of gross debt as a share of GDP over the medium term, reflecting both obviously the effect of the nominal GDP base, which has changed quite a bit, as well as the budget deficit, which flows from GDP. The bright red bars over here, obviously what was presented last week, somewhat of an improvement compared to what was presented in the MTBPS, in line with what the PBO expected in terms of the direction. Again, this is a very precarious outlook. We've noted historically that budget deficit and debt to GDP projections over the medium term have been subject to continuous revision given the uncertainty associated with both revenue and economic performance. In addition to that, I think it's important to underscore the risk to this outlook that emanate not just from the pandemic, but also support to SOEs, particularly contingent liabilities that may realize, as well as other forms of on-budget support, which have certainly been the case and quite strong and pronounced over the past 7 to 8 years. Going forward, this is something to keep a keen eye on, because this outlook could change quite significantly. And in its current form, current outlook, even if this is if there's no significant upside risk, the debt service costs associated with this debt outlook are still high going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues. Chairperson, I think as other members, this slide is what we're doing and trying to give some update on the text and the proposals discussed. I think this slide, what it does, just shows some of the proposals in particular relation to the personal income tax, such as the personal income tax budget, what it does in the revenue. The main potential revenue for gone, but I think the net difference set out by the some of the indirect taxes proposals were to realize the net difference that brought about by adjusting the personal income tax brackets percentage. Next slide. This table, Chairperson and other members, what it does, we thought it would be useful to show this table, because this table shows the taxpayers in terms of different brackets, breaking down to show how many taxpayers the bracket and how much it contributes to personal income taxes and the major tax expense that we saw. So from top to bottom on the far left, it just shows the brackets, and the next column shows the number of registered taxpayers that touch. But I think the purpose of showing this is also to show that the adjustment of the tax brackets will certainly provide relief to some households, particularly based on this tax brackets, the adjustment of the the tax bracket by 5% above inflation will provide relief to some households. And this relief will certainly largely be going to middle to lower income earners when you look at the brackets coming from, I mean, when you look at the brackets from 7,000 to going upwards, I mean, they only share 20% of the adjustment relief, and the bulk of this 20% above 20% will go to the low income households, which can provide some relief to households. And I think that's shows that there is a bulk inflation increase in tax markets, and that will provide some relief to households in time and as so that was slide that to show that in terms of adjustment. Next slide. And also, of course, last point about the, we've also seen adjustments on the medical credit. Inflation, I think the point you want to highlight on the adjustments of the medical credit is that it's only limited to households or to taxpayers who have medical aid, so those who don't have medical aid don't necessarily benefit from the adjustment. This slide talks about some of the policy shifts, the thinking which government is going through, which shows that there has been a long debate discussion in terms of reducing some of the tax expenditures, which generally are about giving decisions to business to the sector to encourage investment. And some of these are being written down, but also some of them are going the big one is 12J, which government has really realized the objective, which in a sense, Chairperson or members, is in line with some of the literature shows. There hasn't been really clear conclusive evidence that actually giving away incentives always result into more investment or more employment. It's kind of less, you know, have mechanism of disciplining the uptake to ensure that it's realized. So that's what it's nice. And it's also realized that there has been governance, even the travel allowance in relation to the working from home, see how that you work. So that's what it's nice. And last point about the fact that government has taken away $8 billion just supposed to raise, but the attempts to support households and the economy and the business. The next slide, Chairperson, in one of us also talks to the broader question around reforming corporate income tax regime, which government has mentioned for years, and we've seen proposals, even though it's not quite cancelled in the numbers cancelled in the red book, we've seen government proposing that to lower corporate tax from such a rate from 8% to 12% effectively. But however, we've not seen that. And this is the line, so I think the emphasis in the budget that it would be very strong to ensure that there isn't going to be lost in that regard. Hence the limiting of the just expenditure deductions and also some of the assets also that realized by some of the businesses that need to pay taxes there. So I think the point, I thought this slide should provide some of the information that could be useful in the discussion going forward as finance committees are presenting proposals in that. One point we highlight is the fact that lowering tax rates, even tax rates, let's say, it's not always a major factor in investment, in investors considering investing in countries or investing money. And that should be clearly spelled out as how we're going to make sure that taxes are lowered or taxes are taken out to business only to relevant objectives. And we had the one slide studying of the intergovernmental forum started as a member of. It has shown that actually, out of 10 factors considered by investors, investing in the economy, tax is one of the lowest considerations, which is the point that they need to clearly understand what are some of the reasons why that's the best that we have. And we've also shown, despite the corporate tax rate being 28%, actually, South Africa is in line with some of the similar countries in our level of development, where the idea is that developing countries rely a lot on income tax, including corporate income tax, more a source of government revenue more than developed countries. So in a way, the thinking around it should be very much in the back of mind. We realize that we're going to collect all the income tax as opposed to other taxes. If you can see that the two corporate income tax, major ones, account for almost 50% of the level. So it's very important to take that into account. We've also shown that despite the rate being 28% of corporate tax, the actual tax paid by businesses and taxpayers, corporate taxpayers, is actually far lower than that, which, you know, effective tax rate. We've seen that effective tax rate is actually to a certain extent, we've seen to be lower than 50%, is far lower than many other countries, including the developing countries. And also, you know, the actual effective tax rate, the sector's also lower than effective tax rate. Particularly with the mining sector, which is reported to be below 10%. Now, you know, about all this discussion about tax, it's very important to take into account that actually the small business enterprise and informal business continue to experience quite high tax liabilities compared to their large counterparts in South Africa, in particular due to some of the compliance costs associated with paying tax needs and also getting the deduction. So therefore, very important that government continue to lead the discussion of investment in the state, drive investments, as this will provide this confidence in the economy to also invest. Next slide. I think these are some of the conclusion slides. So basically, Chairperson and members, what we say is that the financial transition fund mainly towards ensuring energy security over the medium term. And we've seen that the expenditure allocation has been highly skewed towards consultants as opposed to cost of employees. The direct budgetary interventions to grow our economy are not being seen throughout in the budget itself. But also some of the key proposals are of budget, which will basically discuss government's control over its mechanisms, high level of unemployment and poverty and equality. Most of that coming out from COVID-19, we've seen quite a lot of high employment, more poverty, more certainly a bit of risk than considering the budget process that is taken into account at the challenge especially fiscal policy and monetary policy can be used in a mutually reinforcing way to grow the economy. And also what we've decided that the adjustment of tax bracket by 5% will provide some household, which will ensure that their tax liability remains low or remains similar to the previous financial. And lastly, Chairperson, the next slide, Michelle. We also emphasize that lowering the corporation of tax rate or giving tax does not always lead to increasing investment levels, and therefore the importance, emphasize the importance of government driving investment in the economy, which will cause the tax investment to start. Large deficit increase in budget deficit, compromise stability of public finance, the less government can stimulate the economy. So economic growth, the emphasis in economic growth is very important for the investment, is very important to reduce the debts and deficits in the economy. Total amount of government debt is expected to increase over time as well, and as for remains one of the risks that which is the content. Honorable Chairperson, honorable, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jantjies. Indeed, it had been at some stage very difficult for members to, you know, to hear what you were saying. But hopefully next time you would correct that. So thank you very much. Honorable members, I think we've been listening quite well during the presentation as it was done. So what I'm going to do now, because we started a bit 15 minutes late, so I'm going to give each and every the hands at least a minimum of 3 minutes each member to interact with the presentation that has been made. So we take note of those honorable members who said they will be leaving at 10 o'clock. But let me, without any waste of time, take hands to interact with the presentation made by the PBO. Can I note hands perhaps? Yeah, preferably the hands that will be leaving very soon. I've noted Honorable Skosana and Honorable Imam Sheikh. Yes, can I see more hands so that we interact with the presentation and get to understand what is the take of the Parliamentary Budget Office on the analysis that they've made on the budget. So, okay, are there any more hands, honorable members? I only see two hands here. Okay. Perhaps you are still suggesting digesting the input. I would expect to see some hands after this. Let me give Imam Sheikh, and then followed by Honorable Skosan. Can you switch on your video?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much, and thank you for your indulgence that I am actually multitasking, although I'm getting paid one salary, but that's fine, I accept that. Thank you for that. Yeah, one of my concerns appears to be that, particularly on the NHI, and you know that the President has not mentioned anything about in his address on the NHI, and there is a budget cut on the health. And I'd like you to tell us what is the impact going to be particularly on that. The second thing is this, there is no mention which we've previously discussed, and that was the issue of the state bank. But more importantly, in order to boost the economy, we introduced which what we call the Human Settlement Development Bank to enhance housing, which is a crisis in the country. There is absolutely no mention of that. And more importantly, it would look like, and while the Minister of Human Settlement rightfully alluded to the fact that we will not in future build houses, but we will provide fully serviced sites, she's having a major problem in rolling that out as a result of the poor performance of the municipalities themselves in being able to provide these fully serviced sites, which is obviously going to impact and have a problem, or it's going to increase the levels of inequality in the country. And I'd like you to comment on that. Now, on the one hand, we talk about reducing the public service wage bill. On the other hand, we talk about creating 700,000 more jobs in the public sector. I'd like you to give me a response in terms of that. How do we balance that? Because there is no doubt that the public service wage bill is extremely high, 650 billion in the country. And how do we anticipate reducing that if we continuously create more jobs in the public sector rather than creating a conducive environment in the private sector? We also talk about reducing our debt to the GDP, and I'm not sure how we're going to do that because expenditure appears to continue rising. There is no attempt to reduce the expenditure. And based on that, you know, we're expecting the debt to go up to about 5.2 trillion in the medium term. Now, the other problem is this, we must accept that the levels of poverty is going to increase, protest action is going to increase in the country, because even though we have created some jobs, many more have lost their jobs, and like you said, 836,000 jobs I think have been created. But what is very important is that many of those that lost their jobs, or in other words, let me rephrase that, many of them that have entered the job market are now new employees. And what we find is that many companies, in order to reduce cost, are retrenching older or long-standing employees to cut down their cost, employing new people at a reduced cost which is impacting on those people that have lost their jobs already. So I'd like you to give us an indication as to how this is generally going to affect. Now, the other thing, and I'll stop at the last one and give the others an opportunity, which we welcome, is the issue of the manufacturing industry in the country, buying local. But over the years, we have found that all we have been doing is talking about localizing and enhancing the manufacturing industry. And it is my understanding that unless you sit down together with the labor unions and all the role players, the current cost of doing business, particularly for the smaller businesses, and that is why they have become the victims, particularly during COVID-19, and many of them have closed down, is that they cannot sustain the high cost of doing business, meaning they cannot be competitive with their counterparts, and particularly the imports that are coming into the country. Could you advise what you think should happen in that? I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, ma'am, Honorable Skosan.
Oh, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and greetings to all members and to the PEPO. Yeah, I think we want to welcome the presentation by the PEPO. I think from their presentation, I think what I could get is that I think they are saying that in the May, as bad as the budget it was, but it was actually quite better than what was expected from their own point of view. Looking at the growth outlook, they are, I think, indicating that it looks better than what was expected. And that also, looking on the debt to GDP, it also looks better than what was expected. And also the issue of adjustment to tax bracket, which gives a relief to low-income households, which is good. I also agree with them on that. However, just on one aspect, on the nominal increase in social grants, I might have missed, I think, their comment on that, because looking at the number of people who have lost jobs in the previous year due to the rippling effects of COVID-19 pandemic, the likelihood is that people who are getting grants, they are now going to carry a heavy burden. They are going to feed more mouths. Those people who are losing jobs, young people are losing jobs, middle-aged people are losing jobs. The likelihood is that now they are going to be supported, or they are going to be a responsibility of their parents, of their grandparents who are receiving grants. So now it means people who are receiving social grants, they've got quite an added responsibility now. So I think what is their take as the PPO on this nominal increase to the social grant, which is far below the inflation? What impact is it going to do? What negative or positive impact is it going to have in the economy and in this society in general? Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Can I check once more before I give the PBO to respond, whether are there still more hands that up here? I see one hand from Honorable Abraham. Is there any other hand, Honorable Members?
Honorable Dikhale, I'm trying to raise my hand to this side, but okay. This will not allow me.
Okay.
Thank
I've noted you, Honorable Dikhale. Yes. I think it's the last round. Are there any more hands before I proceed to give? Okay. So I presume that it's, assume that it's only two hands. Honorable Abraham?
Yes, sir. Sir, I have just a few takers, but if you allow me, I will just maybe not show the video for better quality.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Sir, my take really, I just wanted to check first and foremost. On the issues that have been raised in the budget, specifically the issue on Vulindlela, whether in terms of what PBO has seen into the budget, that Vulindlela is some kind of economic reconstruction. I'm asking this because there seems to be a cry from the side of not a cry as such, but Treasury seems to be saying that they also need other departments to come to the show. What is the view of PBO in as far as that is concerned? And just quickly, Chair, you know, figures here given are nominal, not real. And this does not give an accurate reflection of the reality. The question is, why does this continue to happen? Secondly, quickly, Chair, under the EXPWP, it is stated that the budget does not support the figures expected to grow under the program. Now, if theoretically and empirically contraction expansion is not the answer, what then is the answer? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Abrams. Honorable Dikale.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all the members. Let me join my colleagues in thanking the PBO for the presentation. Chairperson, I'm not going to touch on what they have presented, but I'm going to ask on what I thought they will mention when they were touching on all different departments that they talked about, and they did not touch on the issue of the women. Chairperson, these are the people who are always close to, 90% of them are always close to people who are abusing them, and they are always close to sharing tears. Actually, they are always in pain. And during the open of parliament, I was happy when the president was touching on the issue of these women, that at least he's looking at giving them 40%. If ever my ears were wide open, and I've had minutes to hear what the president was saying. And now I was thinking that maybe when they talk about the policy priorities, they'll touch on the issue of assisting these women. That's my worry, Chairperson. If the PBO can just say something about assisting, especially those who are in the rural areas, and even the urban areas who are not working. We have had, Chairperson, during when there was this closing of everything during the COVID-19 lockdown, that almost most of the family members, the people who were abused, was the women and the children and the girls. But then now my worry is, where are they in this presentation? Is there anything that they can tell us about them? That's why I wanted to raise my hand, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Dikale. Just before I give the PBO to respond, maybe let me also come to a few items here. I just want to quickly check, because you know we have Eskom has this challenge. We have the challenge of, you know, Eskom has presented with a number of challenges, including the issue of, you know, electricity supply, you know, consistently and some disturbance, which reflect back to energy security. And what the PBO is saying here is not, you're saying that this is not prioritized. I don't know, maybe what you find as some reason there, what the PBO thinks it's the main reason there. Because one would think that maybe as during this difficult time where we have challenges in Eskom, so the issue of energy security was something that's supposed to be, you know, prioritized, and that calls upon us that we have to put a close look, we have to have a close look on that matter. you talked about on the expanded public works program around, I mean, for 2021 financial year, that program seemed to have disappeared, but you did not explain disappeared to where. Do you mean it is no longer featuring or it's no longer budgeted for? But I just want to get clarity as to where did that disappeared to. And then on the issue of, you know, social grant, especially social relief, now that the government has extended this to 3 months period, are there any reason that maybe this shouldn't be permanent, or what is the view, what do you advise the committee as a PBO, given the situation that you have talked about, the high level of unemployment, actually acknowledging that, and inequality as well? And also want to know whether how does the budget also respond to issue of unemployment, inequality, and poverty? Exactly that, because our main aim at the end of the day is to see the overall, you know, the overall picture covering these areas that I've referred to. So now, the last thing is on the corporate tax. You say it's lower than 15%, which you think is unusual. I would have thought that maybe it was supposed to be assisting, but you are saying it's lower than 15%. So even if it was increased, you say it's lower than 15%. So I would want to understand perhaps what was the projection around this issue of corporate tax, because I think that it also acknowledged that your earlier statement that says the company or the private companies have been taxed very low, their tax contribution is very low, if I understood you very well. So does it corroborate with the statement of the 15% tax that you said earlier, or what? So I just want to get that, because if it, then it's lower, it may mean that the corporate tax is even more worse than the way it is presented to be, so very low. So it is not assisting in actual fact. So thank you very much. Let me give you Dr. Janjis and your team to respond on the members' clarities and questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. Dr. Lan just started and we'll take it. Dr. Lan.
Yes, thank you. Basically, I just wanted to respond to Honourable Sheikh on the NHI. The total reduction in the NHI, Honourable Sheikh, was 394 million. obviously that will have an impact. So it was spread throughout the different programs, of which the biggest one was the revitalization component. But we've also done that briefing on the entire health sector and the grants on health sector, which actually showed that that grant didn't spend and that didn't produce any outputs. There was basically very slow spending and low performance on that grant. So in fact, it makes sense to basically reduce the revitalization component of the NHI grant, but it will have an effect, but in any case, they didn't perform before. The other big amount was national health insurance, the indirect proportion on the non-personal services, goods and services, that has been taken away. But we will also have a briefing on that brief that we've sent out and the analysis that we did, and it includes the NHI grant. What we can see in many of these cases, the reprioritization where funds were taken away in terms of conditional grants were that in the grants that did not perform in the past. And then there was another thing in terms of assisting women. Honourable, it's very difficult to now, in a very short time, provide you with information on, because women are basically mainstream throughout all government departments, but the Department of Women specifically has been reduced by 57.9 million. So we can do analysis to see where women feature in all the different departments and also our departments has performed or made progress in terms of women, because women are included in justice, they are included in police, they are included in social development. Basically, in all the departments, there are components of women and youth. And especially in terms of the supply chain, there are policies in place that a certain percentage of expenditure must be in terms of women. And in the police department, the protection of women in terms of the abuse that you mentioned. That is basically what I wanted to respond on. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, if I can come in.
Yes, you can come in.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to start off with the question that Honourable Sheikh Imam asked about, you know, how do we reduce the GDP level? Are we seeing, you know, expenditure increasing and over time debt going up? Now, I mean, one of the things about government spending and also government provision of support and grants, so not only during the pandemic, but also in general, and I think this also relates to a question about the permanence of certain, Honourable Chair, of permanence of social grants, is that, you know, government does take money from the economy and from people through revenue, through taxes and other things, but it also spends money through infrastructure investment, but also giving people social grants and other kinds of support. And especially when unemployment is really high, that social support has very high, what we call multipliers, not only in financial terms, meaning that the money that people get grants spend in the economy, each rand creates more rands in GDP, but also in terms of thinking about the health and social welfare of households, society and its social fabric, the people whose children aren't going hungry, perform better at school, they're more healthy, so it affects, it's got a generational impact. And so in terms of answering the question, you know, should certain of these social grants, and I know there's a discussion about, for instance, the basic income grant, I think there should be permanence to more than that. And I think this relates very much also to the question of women. And we saw in the pandemic, and this is not only South Africa, but globally, that women, and especially women-headed households, were much more impacted by the crisis. Lots of were affected because of lockdowns, children not being able to go to school, reductions in income. And so the grants and support government gave made a big difference. But I think, for instance, if government had made the child grant support during the pandemic a child rather than a household, that would have had a much bigger impact. So I think I agree with Nelia that, you know, there has been a real effort to mainstream the issue of women and women's situation, well-being, across government in different government departments. But I think in the situation where we have such high levels of unemployment and inequality, the kind of society we have and the mores and relationships we have, women are disadvantage more than men, and I think more should be done in consideration of that, and especially in supporting households and children. So to come back to the question about how do we use it to GDP, so in contrast to this idea of contractionary expansion, you actually have expansionary expansion, and by government supporting expansion through stimulus, through increasing social grants and the health of and finances of poor households, you actually increase aggregate demand, household spending, and this creates a business confidence that drives increased investment, job creation, higher GDP growth, and more revenue for government. And so you get more revenue and more GDP, and so your debt to GDP levels come down. So it is possible, and I think we're seeing this strategy across the world now, especially in developed countries. The EU and the US. The US, the Congress has just passed Biden's second stimulus program. They're looking at giving each household $1,200. They initially spoken about $2,000. This would be the second payment to every household, rich and poor, almost like a basic income grant support. And this is basically because they understand that business actually needs that boost in household consumption. And as we showed in our presentation, that even using the numbers in the budget review, which we think are exaggerated or overestimated with growth and investment, but there's so much dependence on growth in the MTF on household consumption that I think it's really important that we think about how we support household consumption more, and also into that. The second question by Honorable Sheikh Imam was about I think stimulating manufacturing. And this also relates to aggregate demand in the economy, especially for small businesses. So big businesses can benefit from increased aggregate demand in other countries. So if China grows or the US grows or Europe grows, we can get more imports of South African products. And the mining companies and companies that are large enough to export will benefit. But small businesses depend very much on aggregate demand in the domestic economy. They depend on how much money is being spent by South African households, what they're buying. And also, so the nature of our growth is dependent, I think, very much at the moment on household consumption. And the quality of our growth in terms of will this household consumption spur on the kind of investments that support households to actually be more economically active, invest, get the kind of jobs, including more labor-intensive jobs that small and medium-sized businesses are going to depend very much on how much support government gives to households to increase household consumption and overall aggregate demand, and that then will create incomes in small businesses that allow them to invest. And then I think the issue of cost of doing business reduces because profitability depends on how many people buying. So it's not only in accounting and economics, we also talk about the turnover effect. How many times people can come into your shop or go to your website and buy in a month rather than, and that depends on incomes and also consumer confidence. And at the moment, because poverty and unemployment increase, but consumer confidence as well. So I'm taking a long time on these questions, but I think they're really important questions. Just on Honorable Aitken's point about now, we weren't accusing Treasury of sort of a problem by using nominal numbers in the budgetary group. In fact, they use both nominal and real numbers. But it's accounting standard when you're presenting your accounting numbers to use nominal numbers in business and in government. But when you see in the Treasury's economic analysis, as in PBO's economic analysis, we move towards using real numbers, because in economic analysis, you have to take into account the buying power of money and the impact of inflation. With its, if it's businesses, we talk about PPI, not CPI. Sometimes we look at the GDP deflator in certain macro analyses. Just to be clear, we weren't actually making an accusation against Treasury. We were just saying that in the first section of our report, we presented nominal numbers, which is correct, and what they do to the budget people. And in the second part that I presented on the economy, we presented real numbers, because we were comparing performance economically over time, and we have to take into account inflation in that. The question of the last one I'll touch on, and I'll actually let our director talk more about it, because he's the tax expert in the office. But just on your question, Honorable Kayiso, you know, what we were talking about is the difference between, you know, the legislated corporate income tax rate and what is described as the effective tax rate. And that's actually what corporations end up paying after incentives and other things. Sometimes if you, on average, if some are making losses, and they end up not paying taxes, some may even be tax rebates, etc. So overall, the effective tax rate on corporations could be 15% or lower, even though the legislative rate is 28%, and in fact, actually being reduced in 2022 to 27%. And I think the director can go into what we said about whether this can be effective in. So I'll stop there and pass on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, colleagues, I shall quickly also
Dr. Jantis, just before you come in, because you're going to sum up and step off, I just want to allow this thing in hand just basically, because I was aware that network has been a problem to some of the members here. So I just want to give the member the about 2 minutes so that you also take a package to everything now, and Honorable Skosana. Let me give, just before you sum up, Dr. Jantis, Honorable Mlenzane and Honorable Skosana. 2 minutes each, honorable members. Our time is running out of our meeting.
Thanks, Chairperson, for the opportunity. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Chair, let me also ask that I switch off the video because of the network challenges. Chairperson, for me, it's not a lot, but that one broad question, Dr. Jantis. What is your understanding of austerity, the generic understanding of austerity, in line with what we see now in terms of the drop in terms of the budget, the cuts and all? Then the other one, Chair, is you know, the public sector investment has declined since 2017 and is now getting back to the 2017 level. What are the implications? You know, Dr. Jantis, your presentation indicates that there is an increase in payments to consultants while there is a decline to employees. What are the implications of this into the running of public service, you know, by consultants. Then the last one, Chair, would be the effect of tax rate in the presentation is lower than 15%. What are the implications for revenue generation? 10 cents, Chair, thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Spokesman.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
You mean that?
I did not hear the answer to my question. So I hear you talking about Dr. Janti's summing up. I don't know if that sum up will also include the answer to my question. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Okay. No, I think so. Dr. Janchis will come in other areas that needed some more response. Dr. Janchis?
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I just want to make sure you can hear me properly. Can you hear me properly, Chairperson?
Yes, it's crying, although difficult, but then we're already in the session now. I can't stop you now.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much. I'll switch off my video. I think just to emphasize the importance that we our presentation message sending out is that the investment is a very important part that we think will support the economic growth, will support businesses, will support households, more investment in the economy. I think it's important that we're trying to decide a lot as opposed to taking our money from the economy or, you know, cutting expenditure. So I think there's a need to try to balance the issue of trying to, you know, balance the books, and also trying to ensure that we don't hurt the economy in the process of balancing the book. I think that's the message they're trying to put out there. But I think the issue of from our presentation, not only saying the changes that budget prioritizes actually energy security. Now that's what we're trying to, not that the other way around. We're saying that the budget actually does prioritize energy security. And we've also shown that the exposure for ESCOM contingent liability has also reduced by 10 billion, which could be a good sign as well that there's a bit of more space for debt for ESCOM this time. I think the issue of social relief being a permanent issue, I think the important issue is to focus on creating more jobs, you know, creating more investment in the economy, and creating more, just supporting small businesses, ensuring that, you know, the small jobs that create are sustainable. But I think the issue of whether the social relief being permanent is something that we can take on, and maybe because we need to show what are the implications for social economy, and also for the private sector. So it might be an issue we're trying to get over time. So there's a research for the committees and report back on that point. The point on the also, I mean, I'm in the point on our leader raising it up. I think the point we're emphasizing is that it's important to raise money to economy as opposed to money on the economy in this current state that we with a lot of uncertainty. And of course, we have to rely on our sector to play part, but I think government has more, well, we've seen globally that government has played more role in the economy by, you know, providing more stimulus in the economy, particularly around this time of low economic growth. So that's the power I'm going to ask the question, because I know it's very contested by different commentators. I think the issue on compensation of employees, whether the consultants, we're just showing that we're seeing that there has been increase in spending on consultants, and in contrast that with the supply in the field. And I think maybe we're trying to see, you know, whether that does really mean that we're taking away jobs for consultants, which would have an impact on the sustainability of service providers, or which lines are being, which areas of employment are being reduced to support service. I think we need to look at the future before we say whether our participation can be. I think Dr. Mohammed touched quite well on the issue of effective tax rate. I think, Chair, what we're saying with regards to effective tax rate, saying the message that we're trying to put out is that there needs to be a clear objective in terms of reforming the corporate tax, income corporate tax regime. That's the message. There needs to be a clear objective to say, what is the objective of trying to reform income tax regime to ensure that residents actually lose out much in their revenue? But also, we've seen new business models coming into mainstream, more so that during time of the COVID, we've seen rapid disassociation of finish activities and so on. So the message about the status quo is to say, what is the main objective for not informing this, and how does it pan out in terms of the public finances, transforming economy, ensuring responses are supported, and also creating more jobs. Now that's the biggest thing we're seeing out. The point there was saying that the corporate tax rate might be 28%, but that's not the real effective state on tax rate. Tax are actually paid by the corporate taxpayers. Because when you look at the actual tax rate, it's actually far below the actual corporate tax rate. And I think that's also the point that government is saying, let's rather, the reason for having corporate effective state tax rate is because there are allowances, deductions, and reliefs that allow that the tax rate should be lower than what it would have been if they were able to use expenditures. And that's what government is trying to say. So let's rather reduce these expenditures and try to reduce the level of tax costs. Obviously, when you look at it, it looks quite big, 28%. I think in reality, it's not 28%. It's far lower than 28%. So government is saying, let's rather make sure that when you look at it and where how you feel it is the same. You know, let's rather reduce the taxing, but at the same time, reduce expenditure to ensure that there is no loss of government revenue. I think I'll just stop there for the sake of time. I feel that it should take much time for us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Jantjies and your team, PBO, for making a presentation today. Hopefully we'll take forward of your good advice that you have given the committee, and you are now released, or if you don't mind, you sit around with the with us as we going to deal with the next presentation that is going to be made by FSC. So we want to thank you very much, PBO and the team, entire team. Thank you very much. Now, honorable members, we are going to switch over to the next item, which is the presentation by the FFC. Can I call upon the team leader of the FFC to make a presentation? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I will move over to Co-Chairperson, Honorable Joe.
Should I wait for the co-chairperson?
I'm saying you must make a presentation.
Thank you. Thank you very much, honorable members and members of the public and the media. We're very happy to be here as the Finance and Fiscal Commission. And the way we would like to proceed is that I want to hand over to our research team, led by Mr. Chen Zeng, who will make go through our presentation, which I hope has been circulated to you, and then I'll make some concluding remarks. By the way, in case you don't know, I'm Michael Sachs. I'm the deputy chair of the FFC. We're looking forward to having a chair appointed soon, but until then, I am the acting chair. Thank you, and over to Chen.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Honorable Chairs and Members. The 2021 budget seeks to balance economic recovery and restoring public finances, as alluded to in the 2020 MPPPS, notwithstanding the four priorities set out, as also earlier the PPO team has presented. So I shan't go into it, except to say that the furthermore, the backdrop, just to put more colors into it, is of a contracted economy that started even before the pandemic, and now made worse by the pandemic with heightened uncertainties. More specifically, the unemployment rate reached its new structural, we would argue, a peak at 32.5% that has never been seen before, as poverty and inequality steepened, as well as the widening budget deficit due to revenue shortfalls and emergency government spending, coupled with the rising debt service cost, requires drastic steps to avoid a debt spiral. It is with these considerations that the Commission makes this submission on the 2021 budget. Moving to the focus on the structural changes in the economy, South Africa's gross domestic product, GDP, contracted by 17.1% year-on-year due to COVID. However, there are some signs recovery as this is merging as lockdown restrictions ease, and also a president's announcement last night, allowing business activities and household activities to resume. As the lockdown restriction eases and people emerge from their homes, we saw a large movement of people out of the not economically active category, actually because they couldn't even search for jobs during the lockdown in quarter two, back into the labor force in quarter three and four. Though mostly as, and this is where this issue lies, unemployed rather than employed. So unemployment rate rises. In absolute terms, just to put it in real figures, is a total of 7.2 million individuals are without a job or income at the moment. Furthermore, due to the pandemic, household consumption expenditure contracted substantially by nearly 15% year on year due to the employment and real disposable income losses suffered. As you can see, that is a significant drop off. In terms of the fiscal framework and revenue proposals, just to highlight a couple of key points here, comparison between last year's budget, the 2020 budget, shows the significant downward adjustment, of course, in the tax revenue projected for this financial year, the 2021, with a shortfall of 132.6 billion in addition. On the other hand, despite the reprioritization, repurposing and consolidation, expenditure was only adjusted by 23.4 billion, resulting in the main budget deficit increasing by 116.2 billion to a total of 482.6 billion deficit for the 2021 fiscal year alone. Kindly note, of course, that the two expenditure items that grew between the two budgets were debt service costs, which increased by 11.3 billion to a total of 269.7 billion that we have to pay this year just for interest, and provisional allocations not assigned to votes for the expansion of a series of COVID supports. To cover for this increase in budget deficit, at 116.2 billion for the 2021 fiscal year, the government has looked to raise additional funds, as this table shows, not in the short-term domestic loans, as many would think, but long-term domestic debts and foreign loans, as well as sacrificing the available cash, redemptions, and other balances as 122.6 billion. In sum, South Africa's risk, to put it in terms, is the risk of falling into this debt trap remains, with more loans, cash, and debt service costs raised, needed, and required to finance the increased deficit. This figure just shows the fiscal trajectory in a different perspective, as current receipts versus payments over the coming three fiscal years, or the 2021 NDEF. Specifically, despite the fall in current receipts, the fiscal policy reacted with extraordinary measures to support the vulnerable in current payments as COVID response, resulting, however, the significant widening of that budget deficit. And lastly, as noted by honourable members and chair, the joint meeting briefing by the minister last week regarding forecast accuracy of economic growth, there is also, we would like to note, a slight bias in terms of revenue forecast as presented here that is worth noting, which could potentially harm the fiscal credibility of our fiscal position. Now I'd like to hand over to Sasha, please.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Chair, members, and other colleagues. This section will basically highlight some of the key trends that come out of our assessment of the 41 national votes. And as you'll see from the figure on that slide, allocations in respect of the national department is projected to decrease over the next 3 years. With the largest cut set to be implemented in 2021. And whilst various spending items within the national votes will be cut, the one significant and cross-cutting item that will be cut is spending on compensation. Now, on average, spending on compensation accounts for about 18% of total national departmental spending, so it's a big cost driver. And in terms of the cuts to compensation, they are projected over all 3 years of the MTEF period, again with the largest cut set for 2021-22. And we'll just caution here that relying on cutting compensation as a means of reining in spending obviously comes with risk, especially if the cuts do not materialize. And already we saw headlines yesterday and this morning that hint at how tough these wage negotiations are going to be, with unions reportedly set to ask for inflation plus 4%. So there are inherent risks to this approach. If we move to the next slide, please. So we would like to highlight just a couple of trends, again, from our analysis of the national appropriation. And just to point out that this analysis is based on the real change from the 2020-21 revised estimate relative to the figures projected over the next 3 years. So given that in 2020 it was an extraordinary year, we saw various programs being ramped up and others being deprioritized, the trends that we see should be viewed in that light. But we thought it provides some insights into changes in prioritization, particularly in the next financial year. So the first point is that in many instances, the cuts seem to be affecting the poor and vulnerable. And of course, the first example there relates to the reduction to social development. And the funding to this department is set to decline significantly in 2021, the new financial year. And we can understand why it's such a big cut, since many of the temporary provisions and grants established last year were located under this vote and will be phased out over the coming months. But we also note that there will be a real decline in social security grants over the next 3 years. And as we know, social security grants provide critical income support to the poor. And as such, the Commission is concerned about how this cut will affect the many grant recipients and those that rely on this income, especially given that whilst there is this projected real decline, the number of beneficiaries is expected to increase. And I think the budget review estimated the increase to be around 300,000 over the next 3 years. The second aspect we'd like to highlight is with respect to ECD. Now, prior to the onset of the pandemic, the ECD sector was already characterized by many challenges related to inadequate funding, poor targeting of existing funding, and a number of other challenges. And then with the onset of the pandemic, the sector was hard hit, with the majority of ECD centers not being subsidized and not registered with SARS. Many workers within the centres also not registered with UIF, so the result was that many centres and their employees were unable to access the relief measures that became available. So the Commission really welcomes the $2.8 billion allocated to the ECD sector as part of the President's Employment Stimulus Relief Fund, and the fact that this relief funding is being made available to registered and non-registered ECD centres. But in addition to the relief funding, the need to significantly strengthen the ECD sector on a permanent basis remains. Research shows that early learning programs set the basis for future academic performance. And if we neglect the sector, it's not only much harder for these children to catch up to their peers later in schooling, but it's also much more expensive from a public finance point of view. So we acknowledge that funding to ECD was significantly ramped up in 2020, especially if you compare what was being allocated in, say, 2019. But in the next financial year, in 2021, there will be a real reduction. And, you know, we just like to, you know, indicate, or, you know, we need to get more information on how this will affect the sustainability of ECD centers going forward. So we also note that there are various initiatives underway, such as, for example, the Vangasali campaign, which aims to register your unregistered ECD centers and which will then enable them to access government subsidies. But, you know, given the plight of the ECD sector, it's imperative that these timeframes are stuck to and that we are fully, you know, we know what is happening with respect to progress in this regard. Then with respect to cooperative governance, the cooperative governance vote where the LES allocation sits, you know, we are set to see a reduction in the LES relative to what municipalities received in 2020. And again, given that the LES assists in funding the delivery of basic services to indigent households, there's a need to appreciate the likely impact again on your poor households. With respect to basic education, the DBE did see positive growth in 2021. Much of this is due to prioritization of education infrastructure. And this is, of course, an improvement relative to the no growth scenario projected at the time of the MTBPS. Of concern in this sector are the cuts to compensation, which, according to the budget review, we are told are likely to affect the number of teachers and class sizes and learning outcomes, particularly in your no-fee schools, which are your poorest schools, you know, with your poorest learners. Then also we see that a number of conditional grant instruments in the sector are set to grow slowly or decline. And we just wanted to raise concern around the conditional grant for learners with profound intellectual disabilities. It's the smallest education conditional grant, and relative to allocations in 2020, you know, this grant will see a bit of a cut in 2022 and over the rest of the two outer years. And in this regard, we'd like to raise concern over progress towards building an inclusive education system that caters for our learners with disabilities. On higher education, there are, again, cuts to the department's baseline over the next 3 years, with subsidies to universities and especially your TVET colleges being affected over the next 3 years. And what, I guess, compounds this is the fact that you will... the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, the NSFAS, will also be facing funding constraints. You know, so there is a key avenues through, the NSFAS is a key avenue through which your poor students can access financial aid. So we need to look at the impact of those projected reductions there. And then on health, the worrying aspects relate to funding for hospitals and health infrastructure, especially given that based relative to 2020 allocations, the National Tertiary Services and Health Facility Revive grants will see cuts. But overall, yeah, I think our advice is that departments need to indicate to Parliament and this committee how they plan to absorb the cuts to the budgets and what exactly will be foregone in terms of service delivery. And I think particular attention should be placed on estimating the cumulative effect of these intended reductions on indigent and poor households. Jennifer, can move to the next slide, please. The slide just points out that there are initiatives across various departments that are directed at trying to stimulate growth, development, and job creation, and just put on a few. The agriculture vote, whereas this vote saw a dip in 2020, it will increase in real terms in 2021. This increase doesn't quite take us back to the allocation level prior to COVID, but there is some real growth projected for the Lima, let's say, my grant. And given challenges around food security and the fact that this grant focuses on food production and assistance to previously disadvantaged farming communities, This is welcomed. We also see attempts at reigniting the tourism sector that has been quite hard hit due to the COVID pandemic and the associated lockdown regulations. The after-sink funds deprioritized during last year. We will see significant real growth and reprioritization of funding to the sector. Then there are also programs and efforts aimed at growing small, medium, and micro enterprises, all of which can have an impact on job creation. So there are many initiatives and interventions, but I think, again, what is key for Parliament, and it's similar to what we're saying for those departments that are seeing big reductions, it's for these departments, you know, to be explicit in terms of how the additional funding and the manner in which the funds have been allocated will contribute to and support economic recovery. And then just the last aspect there relates to pressures facing the key components of the criminal justice system. And here we just highlight the reductions to the police and justice and constitutional development votes. The work of these departments are labor intensive. For example, the police vote spends just under 80% on personnel. It will be important to see how the planned cuts will impact the work of these departments. Chi, I'd like to hand over to my colleague Eddie, please.
Thanks, Pasha. Good morning, honorable members. I'm going to take you through the next couple of slides. The first one, we're looking at the intergovernmental COVID responses and the procurement issues, especially looking at the share of responsibilities in relation to COVID-19 responses. And the reason why we're focusing on this is because one of the key mandates of the Commission is really to focus on the division of revenue and also to ensure that there is equitable division of revenue across the 3 spheres of space. But when it comes to the COVID-19 disaster response, what you actually see is that most of the interventions were disproportionately implemented by the national government. Of course, through some of the extra budget interventions. But going forward, obviously, we need to see some of those interventions also trickling down to the lower levels of government, provinces and municipalities. The second issue to note here is that the Commission welcomes the 10 billion rand allocation given to provinces to deal with COVID-19 interventions. There's also a 6.6 billion allocation which is going to be allocated for national government for vaccination. But really the issue that we really want to highlight in this particular one is that the 6.6 billion may not necessarily be compatible with the government's goal of achieving herd immunity within the 12-month period. Of course, we also note that the minister in the budget statement pointed out that there's about 10 billion or so that has been allocated to the contingency fund. So should there be a need for extra allocation for COVID vaccines, that would be made available. But from the budget perspective, our view is that the 6.6 billion is not necessarily aligned with the government's objective of achieving herd immunity within the next 12 months. Next slide. The next slide, look at the equitable share from the allocations to provinces. Really, the point to highlight here is that the budget makes provision for about 1.5 trillion rand in allocation to provinces in respect of the equitable share formula, and also a further 356 billion in terms of the provincial conditional grant allocation. So really the main point we really want to highlight here is that when you compare the allocation in especially with respect to the provincial equitable share formula from what the 2020 budget announced relative to what the 2021 budget, you see that there's still a very big gap. So it's going to take quite a long time for the provincial equitable share baseline to recover. But again, another important point that we want to highlight here is the fluctuations in the MTEF form of forward estimates. Of course, that is because of the focus that the government has made. But I think as a matter of concern is that with this kind of fluctuations, what it does is it's sending wrong signals, but it can also destabilize provincial budgets in the long run. So really, going forward, I think we really need to be careful about the type of forward estimate that we that the government publish, because they can tend to destabilize provincial budgets. So that needs to be managed very well going forward. Next slide. The next slide here, Honourable Member, still with the issues relating to the provincial equitable share formula. Here, it's just for a matter of information purposes. So the Commission is inundated with submissions every now and then when we meet with provincial legislatures about the concerns on the equitability of the provincial equitable share formula. And we have been doing some work over the years, having made recommendations in 2010, 2020, and also in 2018. But there doesn't seem to be really adoption of this recommendation, and therefore, as a result, we continue to hear these concerns about the equitable share of some provinces. In the 2021 budget, the Commission actually recommended that certain aspects of the cost of norms must be incorporated into the provincial equitable share formula, and government has already responded, indicating that some of those can be taken into account. But the point that we would like to leave the committee with is that the challenges and concerns around the provincial equitable share cannot be resolved solely by changing the formula. So tinkering, that would be amount to tinkering on the margin. So they also need to, going forward, to look at, we also need to look at issues related to vertical division of revenue as well as the accountability issues in respect of the equitable share formula, so that we look at system-wide issues and not just focusing on the formula. Next slide, please. The next slide looks at the conditional grants for provinces. Here, the point to note is that in the main, the provincial conditional grants have really been spared from the cut that we made, especially when we compared to the provincial equitable share formula. So relative to what the 2020 budget announced compared to what the 2021 budget makes provision for, there's only a 5 billion rand difference. So in our view, that means that because some of these conditional grants are responsible for implementing infrastructure, so we see that is a welcome development. But what also has happened is that there's been a large movement within some of the conditional grants, especially the education infrastructure and conditional grants. We see that there's been very big prioritization within that grant. And obviously, as my colleague Sasha has mentioned, that the committee and the legislature must be receiving the reports from the executive as to what the implication of those reprioritization are on some of the plans that were tabled in 2019. For instance, how many schools have been delayed? How many schools are not going to be completed on time? So that we know what the implication or what the impact of this reprioritization are. The table here just shows that some of the cuts that were proposed during the supplementary budget last year, what we see is that with the 2021 budget, we see some of those, many of these conditional grants are beginning to recover. So if you take, for instance, the education infrastructure grant, 2020 the allocation was 11 billion, the supplementary budget revised that to 8 billion, but we see that in 2021, the grant, the baseline is recovering to about 11.6 billion. So that is a welcome development from the Commission's perspective. Lastly, the next question is just to note a few changes that have happened on some of the key conditional grants. So what we have noted over the time is that there's been this constant reprioritization, especially with respect to the Union Settlement Development Grant, a key instrument to deal with the growing housing backlog. So obviously, we also need to know what the impact of those reprioritization are on the delivery of houses, especially given the reprioritization that has happened within this particular grant. We also note that the HIV and HPV malaria community outreach grant has been growing exponentially over the year. But again, the caution that we'd like to mention is that the growth in some of these health-related conditional grants may not necessarily imply that the grants are growing healthy, but it also may be reflective of the failing health system, because it means that preventative measures within of health healthcare preventative measures are not necessarily working, and therefore that we end up having to put a lot of money into these conditional grants for curative measures. The third point that we like to highlight here is in respect of the separation of the informal settlement upgrading grant from the human settlement grant. This for the Commission is a concern because it may really impede integrated spatial planning at the municipal level. The Commission has made a number of recommendations before for consolidation of build program conditional grants. So to see this is now component of the human settlement grant being taken out of that particular bill program, it is a concern, and it may necessarily affect the way in which municipality undertake integrated planning. And then the last point here is that the provincial equitable share must be guarded, and it must remain the default funding mechanism for provincial expenditure responsibilities. Lastly, this is just really to emphasize what my colleague has said, is that Parliament and provincial legislatures must receive the regular reports on the impact of budget cuts and reprioritization, especially even on the vulnerable beneficiaries. If I would ask my colleague Sasha to just complete the slide. Thank you.
Thanks, Eddie. This section hones in on local government. And we note that the COVID-19 pandemic has threatened the viability of many municipalities and has had wide-ranging effects on the pre-existing financial, fiscal, and governance and service delivery challenges that municipalities face. There are also various long-term or legacy issues that are emerging as a result of the pandemic, and these include, for example, your higher municipal debt, as we see revenue falling, and the pandemic has in many instances just laid bare the challenges around access to basic services such as your water and sanitation. If we move to the next slide, please. This slide speaks to the local government fiscal framework and the local government equitable share allocation. And I think there are two points to raise. The first is that the division of revenue share allocated to local government will increase modestly from 9% in 2021 to 9.7% by the end of the medium-term expenditure framework. And this increase does not translate to more resources actually being transferred to the sector, but it's rather the result of reductions to the public service wage pool that affect the national and provincial spheres and which reduces their shares in total government expenditure. So that is the point about the proportional share. And if we move to the next slide, the second point is that the total allocation to the local government sphere will decline over the medium-term expenditure framework, and this is largely due to government's consolidation efforts. And what we see is the LES dropping by 15.5 billion, or by a real annual average of 4% over the next 3 years. We also see a cut in the general fuel levy of 1% per annum over the next 3 years. And local government conditional grants, whilst being reduced by about 2 billion over the next 3 years, will still manage to show real annual average growth of 3% over the MTS period. And as the Commission, we would just like to highlight the drops that we'll see in the equitable share allocation. This 15.5 billion, or in percentage terms, on average 4% per annum, our concern is just the adverse effect that this is likely to have on the delivery of basic services to the poor and vulnerable. And the other Commission would advise municipalities to really just try and strengthen their revenue collection systems and plug any leakages that may exist, as well as harnessing the potential benefits of using smart technologies in their operations. Can we please move to the next slide? Just looking a bit more at the local government conditional grants, as mentioned on the previous slide, despite the cuts, these grants will still see a real annual average increase of 3% over the next 3 years. And when you disaggregate total grants into the two key component parts, which is infrastructure and capacity building grants, and in the figure on that slide, your infrastructure grants are depicted by the green line and your capacity building grants shown by the blue line there. And as you can see from 2021 onwards, or where that vertical dotted red line is, there's a general downward trend in both lines. So in both your infrastructure and capacity building grants over the two outer years. So infrastructure grants fund the development of bulk infrastructure, which underpins the delivery of your basic services. And when we take this trend together with, you know, the drop over the period to the LAS, you know, it implies that basic services may be under some pressure there. Just on the last slide for this section touches on conditional grant baseline cuts. And over the next 3 years, local government conditional grant baseline cuts amount to $2 billion. The overwhelming part of these cuts, or 90% of the cuts, will be in respect of three conditional grants. It's your public transport network grant, your municipal infrastructure grant, your MEG, and then the direct integrated national electrification program, or the INEP grant. And we note that the reason underpinning the cuts relates to underspending. And we just caution that we first need to establish the reason for underspending and try and fix those challenges first, because you know, these grants fund much needed infrastructure, and in some cases these instances of underspending may be symptomatic of bigger challenges that need to be addressed. So first understand the reason for the trends before cutting. So I'd like to now hand over to Thando, I think will take us through to the end.
Thank you, Sasha. Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members. I'm going to take you through two main sections, government debt and contingent liabilities, and also the public sector infrastructure and investment. So starting off with debt and financing costs, what we note is that the gross national debt is estimated now to stabilize at 88.9% of GDP, as it's reflected on the figure on the left. The blue line there represents the much better stabilization of the GDP ratio, debt to GDP ratio, whereas the red line represents what was projected by the MTBS, that's the ratio of debt to GDP will stabilize at 93.3%. So the second thing to note there is that debt service costs are increasing, and on average they are increasing by 13.3% from 232.9 billion in 2021 to 338.6 billion in 2023-24. As reflected again on that graph, if you look at the gray bars there, you see that from 2010, they are continuously increasing up to 2023-24. What is apparent is that then there is a substantial amount of gross tax revenue, almost 22 cents of every rand that's generated in gross tax revenue in 2023-24 goes to bondholders, and that we note that it's perpetuating the already high inequalities that exist within the economy. So in the absence of decisive policy intervention to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio, government will soon find itself in a position where it has to borrow money to primarily pay interest costs on its outstanding debt, and that
we say that will then introduce South Africa into a debt trap. The next point to note is that the increasing interest rate growth differential means that South Africa must raise larger primary balance surpluses in order to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio. And we know that according to the budget review, the surplus will only be, the primary balance will only be in surplus in 24 and 25, and so that means that the government will find it harder to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio going forward. Surpluses imply decreases to non-interest expenditure and tax increases. So clearly, what is important for South Africa is to grow the economy, and that we say it's key. Next slide. So in this slide, we're looking at guarantees to state-owned companies, contingency liabilities, and government guarantees. We've looked at a long trend analysis starting from 2004-05 up to 2024. So what we note there is that contingency liabilities are increasing. For instance, they accounted for 10.3% of GDP in 2004-05, but that figure has increased to 22.5% of GDP in 2021. So clearly they are increasing. And we note that if you look at the two starting in the end period of our length of analysis, there's been an increase of more than fivefold from 156 billion in 2004-2005 to 1.1 trillion in 2020-21. And then the next point to know then relates to government guarantees to SOCs, which also shows a significant increase. For instance, they accounted for 54% of total contingent liabilities in 2021, increasing significantly from 74 billion in 2004-05 to 595 billion in 2020-21. So in 2021-22, guarantees to SOCs amounted to 581 billion, with associated exposure also high at 410 billion. So what's worth noting there is that the financial performance of SOCs putting considerable pressure on public finances. We'll look at the performance of this SOC, the financial performance of this SOCs in a moment. The financial support to SOCs cumulatively reached 129 billion, which is estimated at 2.6% of 2020 GDP between 2021 and 2022-23. So what we want to note today is that while this is already high, what we know for a fact is that COVID-19 has also introduced some shocks to the financial performance of the SOCs. So they, it's possible that they will come back to ask for financial assistance from the fiscals. So the last point we want to make with regards to this issue is that SOCs rating weakness that could translate to credit rating downgrade for South Africa because of their relatively large size and the high probability of mitigating into the public balance sheet. So now moving on to the public sector institution and investment, here we're looking at the financial performance of state-owned companies. So what is worth noting is that state-owned entities have an important role to play in the economy, especially when it comes to provision of basic salaries. But a number of them are not performing well financially. There seems also to be a wastage of public resources emanating from these companies. We see that there has been a poor leadership and also challenges when it comes to procurement issues,
also operational inefficiencies that seem to characterize these companies. So the Commission is of the view that these challenges need to be addressed without further delay, otherwise it will put more funding, it means more funding will not yield any expected returns and economic growth. So if you look at ESCOM, for instance, we see that from 2018 to 2020, ESCOM has been making a loss in their finances. What is apparent is that in 2019, for instance, the loss amounted to over 20 billion rands, which is a huge magnitude of a loss for ESCOM. And also, if you look at the SAA, South African Airways, we see that also from 2016 to 2019, SAA has been making a net loss. Actually, if you look at both 2017 and 2018, you see that the loss exceeded 5 billion rands, which is a substantial amount to lose. So what we see there is that these companies, both ESCOM and SAA, are performing poorly, and they've been making losses over consecutive number of years now. Next slide. So this is the last slide of this section. What we are looking at here is the public sector infrastructure spending. So what is worth noting is that if you look at those two graphs, the one on the left represent public sector infrastructure investment in the actual rents, whereas the one on the right is a share of public sector infrastructure. So the shares are in percentages there. So whichever way you look at it, what's apparent is that the state-owned companies seem to be leading when it comes to government infrastructure spending. For instance, it accounted for 110.5 billion, it increased from 110.5 billion out of the total amount of infrastructure spending, which is 275.9 billion in 2021-22. That's equated to 40.1 of government infrastructure spending that is accounted for by these state-owned companies. So this, we say, is a great concern, given that what you've seen in the previous slide, that there is a poor financial performance from this company. So the Commission's view is that some SOEs in their current form will continue to drain the fiscals if there is no some form of restructuring to turn them around. Chairperson, with your permission, let me stop here and then hand over to our acting chairperson to conclude. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the research team. I think you can, Chen, take down the screen sharing now. I wanted to make a few just concluding remarks. I think as the FFC, we are a creature of the Constitution, and our central concern with this budget is that we are not convinced that it is consistent with the provisions of the Constitution. We're not saying it's not consistent, we're saying we're not convinced, and we think that the Minister of Finance has not gone far enough to convince us that this budget is in line with the Constitution. And let me give you some examples of what I'm talking about. The Constitution says, as you know, that the Bill of Rights is the cornerstone of our democracy, and it is binding on the legislature and the executive. What we see here, I think, is the first time that a budget has been tabled in Parliament which unambiguously envisages a retrogression in social and economic rights set out in the Bill of Rights. So, for instance, the budget for central hospitals in 2019 was around 44.7 billion. The budget for central hospitals in 2021 is estimated at 44 billion. In other words, there will be less money spent on central hospitals in South Africa, hospitals like Chris Hani Baragwanath and Britta Skier and the like. There will be less money spent on those hospitals in 2021 in nominal terms than there was in 2019. But the Constitution says that the state has an obligation to ensure a rising floor of access to health services. So this raises a question. The Constitution also says that nobody may be refused emergency medical treatment. And yet the budget for emergency medical services in 2021 is 7.2 billion rand. Whereas the budget for emergency medical services in 2019, before the pandemic, was 8.2 billion rand. In other words, emergency medical services are a billion rand down from what they were in 2019. As we know, the budget, and the budget for these things, I'm talking about 2021, but if you look over the medium term, it's clear that all of these budgets are falling far below inflation. So we expect to see a real erosion in the value of services provided through central hospitals over the next 3 years. A similar indication is there in basic education. Basic education, by the way, is not a right that the Bill of Rights says must be subject to available resources and a rising floor. It's simply a right that everybody has a right to basic education. And yet the whole budget for basic education is growing below 2% over the next 3 years. A lot of that is around compensation. And the budget review makes very clear on, in fact, it declares on page 59, that the budget for basic education that is being tabled will lead to larger class sizes, right? And this will affect learning outcomes, especially in no-fee schools. So the budget itself, the budget review is saying that we can expect a retrogression in the provision of basic education, particularly in no-fee schools which service the poorest, over the next 3 years. Similarly, we have cuts to social grants. And of course, again, the Constitution is particularly clear on the rights of children. And we've seen, and it says that no child shall be, or every child has a right to basic nutrition, for instance. We've seen recently a significant rise in hunger amongst children. The budget is proposing an inflation-related increase in the child support grant in 2021, but that grant, together with all other grants, is anticipated to fall in real terms, to fall in value over the next 3 years in a context where there's rising child hunger. So I think the point for us is that clearly there are economic realities that the country faces. We have had declining per capita income as a society for the last 5 years or more. And if the National Treasury's projections are anything to go by, we will continue to have declining per capita income over the medium term. And the question has to be raised whether the promise of the Constitution, of the rights in the Constitution, can be realized if we continue to have declining per capita income. Also, as the presentation has made clear, debt service costs are rising, and this is crowding out the space, the fiscal space, for the provision of these social services. Added to that, the above inflation remuneration improvements of public servants, of teachers and healthcare workers, etc., over the last decade has created a dilemma for fiscal planning and is obviously behind some of these measures that are being proposed. But all of that said,
it's not only a story about compensation. For instance, in the education space, it's not only the compensation budget that is growing at around 1%, also the budget for learner and teacher support materials is clearly going to be eroded in real terms over the next 3 years. So the question we are asking is, has government applied its mind to these constitutional questions in presenting this budget? Certainly, there's no discussion of this in the budget review. There's no discussion of the constitutional implications. And neither is there any discussion or evidence that is presented that these services can be maintained in their current state even as the resources devoted to them are reduced. So it may be that there are plans that government has that even though the education budget is being cut, the health budget is being cut, the social grant budget is cut in real terms over the medium term, there may be plans or ideas that government has as how are the basic platform of rights in the Bill of Rights going to be defended, even in the context of those cuts. But we have no indication of that at all in the budget review.
3 minutes left, Mr. Sachs.
Yeah, I'm concluding now. So it may be, so really the issue we're raising before Parliament is that Parliament needs to ask these questions in its efforts to hold the executive accountable, that it needs to hold the ministers responsible, the Minister of Basic Education, the Minister of Health, the Minister of Social Development, and ask them how is the budget consistent, or can they put forward an argument that there will be no retrogression of the rights in the Bill of Rights in the context of this budget. Also, the Minister of Finance needs to be asked when he was weighing the protection of these rights against, for example, cuts to taxation. How did he weigh this thing? And how did he apply his mind to these constitutional imperatives? This is a discussion we need to have now because over the next 3 years, we're going to be seeing per capita spending in South Africa, government spending per capita, non-interest spending, fall by about 15% per South African. That is the plan on the table. So this is not only a discussion about 2021, but this is a discussion we'll be having about 2022 and 2023. And remember that the path of fiscal consolidation that has been put on the table doesn't really result in a consolidation that would unambiguously stabilize debt by the outer year of the fiscal framework. So by 2023, the budget deficit is bigger than it was before the coronavirus pandemic. So the implication is that this retrogression, if I'm right that there is a retrogression taking place here, is not only planned for the next 3 years, but it's set to continue beyond 3 years until debt has stabilized. Now, I'm not arguing that this is a wrong measure. I'm simply stating that if we are going down this path, the onus is on the executive to explain to Parliament and to explain to South Africans the situation we face and what measures it is taking to defend their rights in terms of the Constitution. So thank you very much for the opportunity, colleagues.
Honorable Joe. So will. Right, honorable members, I think we
should...
Oh, so con, okay.
What are you saying? I've just come in now.
You continue, or should I continue?
You can continue, and then I will close
okay,
the meeting.
Okay, thank you very much. Honorable members, presentation has been made, and I'm aware of the time that we have... little space of time, so let us utilize that to pose some questions for input after this presentation. Can I now take hands, honorable member?
Honorable Chair?
Yes, noted, honorable Dennis.
Good Chair.
Honorable Abrams. Honorable Dennis and then Honorable Abrams.
And Honorable Kutsia.
And Honorable Kutsia. And who else? Is there any other one? Okay, let's continue. Honorable Dennis.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, at the outset, I'd like to appreciate the content of the FFC's presentation. Now, in my comments on the PBO the other day, I erroneously quoted the FFC legislation, although the principle remained the same. But I'd like to say that the presentation today really does live up to the FFC's mandate, and I really want to just make that point at the outset. Chair, there's a lot of things, a lot of information, a lot of detail, and a lot of questions I have, particularly coming from my background. I think that you know, I have a lot to learn, and there's a lot of things I'd like to discuss further. I'm going to try and keep it as short as I can. Very interesting comment that I picked up, and I'd like to focus on about local government with the decline in revenue collections. And I think that perhaps Salga needs to come and talk to us at some stage as one or both or all four committees, however we want to do it. But to talk about the decline in revenue collections that has come about in the post-COVID South Africa, you know, the comparison of service revenue collections to equitable share and to what's being paid out for services in bulk services. I think that would be an incredibly interesting analysis to let us see, you know, what the trend is in local government in terms of their sustainability, because it's something that is coming up time and time again, and I think we really need to understand sustainability of local government, particularly when it comes to their bulk payments, you know, how much of their revenue goes towards bulk payments. I think that the comments about plugging revenue leakages, particularly in terms of non-revenue water and electricity losses, was excellently placed and well done. I'd like to ask, how realistic, in terms of the debt, government debt situation, how realistic is the stabilization of debt versus GDP in terms of the projection that Treasury has given us? You know, if you look at the budget review document that was given to us at the budget, you know, they themselves point out to the fact that there's a number of risks that are posed to the projections, and yet we're already seeing some of those risks coming true before the budget was released and being fulfilled afterwards as well. So just the FFC's opinion on the realistic value of the projections that we've been given. You know, Mr. Sachs just pointed to the budget deficit and said, you know, it's gone up, it's instead of going down, which is what we're not supposed to be doing. Are we really going to get it under control? Because what we've seen is the projected budget deficits over the years have not been realized, and we've had bigger deficits than have been projected, certainly in the last year. Mr. Sachs pointed out some of the counterintuitive allocations that have happened, and the fact that money seems to not really be going to the right places, like local government, which is the coalface of service delivery, like provinces, which has a big role to play in service delivery, and in fact the hospitals. I thought that was a very 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 valid point. Chair, I'm going to leave it at that now. Just those comments and then.
Can you sum up? 1 minute?
No, Chair, I'm done for nothing.
Okay. Honorable Abrams?
Yes, thanks, Chair. Chair, let me join the honorable member in really appreciating the presentation from FSC. My first take, Chair, is around the issue of the report. The report says the challenge is not just the formula but systemic. What in terms of the budgeting is being suggested should change? What is suggested should change? And secondly, cuts are reflected without analysis of examining quality expenditure, which often leads to cuts. Surely FSC should be drawing on existing analysis since National Treasury guidelines are clear on non-expenditure. Lastly, Chair, we sit with unfunded mandates at local government level, which are getting even worse. What are your recommendations as FSC? Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Abrams. Honorable Kodzi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, yeah, my appreciation also for this outstanding presentation. I just got a request. Unfortunately, I couldn't find it to follow it on my side. I had problems in following it on the flighted screen, and I'll appreciate it if possible if it can be forwarded to us as well, because I would like to work through that again, because taking all these facts is a great task, so I'd like to have a copy to work through it again, please, Honorable Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Kotia. We are left with about 11 minutes before we close up our discussion. Let me just assure the members that where there are questions which might have not been covered should be covered through writing submission by, we'll ask FSC to, if they did not complete response, and then respond on other questions. But my question was that FSC, 10 years of discussion with National Treasury on the formula and system has not provided a fundamental shift yet. This is in the mandate of the FSC. What is the challenge that recommendations are ignored? The second one is that the presentation states that the 2021 budget is premised upon a risk approach of public service wage reduction. Your analysis of the implications. Third question is, you state that the MTF forecasts are destabilizing provincial budgets. A very serious claim, indeed. Surely, a provincial department adjusts its budget according to what is in the division of revenue. The fourth question is that the claims that the budget does not necessarily continue the progressive realization of the implementation of the Bill of Rights. Besides holding ministers responsible, what are you practically proposing? We want to get that. What is it that you really propose? So I'm saying, in case you did not finish the, and you'll be finishing us with further responses to the question that the honorable members have asked. Thank you very much. Mr. Sext?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I don't know, let me invite other commissioners. I see there are commissioners, Erasmus, Mukadi, Rockman with us. Perhaps I'm missing some from the, but they let me invite them if they want to come in on any of the questions. And I'll invite also Chen to add a little bit, the head of research, particularly on the local government revenue side of things. I think just on the debt sustainability and the debt projections, the truth is that no debt projection is reliable, in fact, because all debt projections require us to look far into the distant future. We have to know what is economic growth going to be, what are interest rates going to be, what is the primary balance going to be, what is the exchange rate going to be, and it's we're living in a time of extreme uncertainty. Much higher levels of uncertainty that we've ever seen before. So we can't say that National Treasury's projection or anyone else's projection is very certain. The big issue really in stabilizing the debt is the balance between, I mean, aside from the deficit itself, is the balance between interest rates and the rate of economic growth. So where the rate of economic growth is higher than the interest rate we pay on our debt, this has a stabilizing effect on debt. And if the interest rate is higher than the economic growth rate, it has a destabilizing effect. So we don't really know what the rate of economic growth will be or the rate of interest will be in 5 years' time. So it's very difficult to say. But we do know now that the rate of growth is far below the interest rate that government pays on its debt. If you take the 10-year bond yield, for instance, which is the kind of benchmark interest rate, that's around 9%, whereas the rate of growth in nominal terms is projected to be around 6% over the medium term. So all we can do is try and find a solution that or move towards some debt stabilization. And really, I would think that the task of raising the economic growth rate is going to be a much more effective path to debt stabilization than the path of cutting the budget is going to be, or at least if we just cut the budget without having that revival in economic growth, it's going to be a very painful and very long path to debt stabilization. Chen, do you want to come in on the equitable share formula? Go on.
Thank you, Chair and Chairs and Honourable Members. Very quickly on that is that we note that the request has been made by the committee, I think it was on appropriation or even the joint, on the issue of local government equitable share formula. And we also note that the 10 years of this review doesn't seem to have made any real changes in terms of the share of the fiscus that goes to into the sector. I think the problem lies, if I may, in 10 years since inception, is that one has to perhaps start thinking of the separation or somewhat a distinction, differentiate between local government equitable share and local government equitable share formula. I think that is where, if we remember, our late chairperson, Daniel Blakey, used to say, it's local government equitable share formula is the wrong conversation. And what I think the issue here is that distinguishing or differentiating, at least conceptually, the difference between vertical division, which is the equitable share, local government equitable share, provincial equitable share, and obviously the national direction, the appropriation, and equitable share formula, which is more about the horizontal division after that vertical pool has been decided. Thank you, Chair. I'll stop there.
So let me also just point out, and I think this is important for all analysts, including those at the FFC, but also at the Parliamentary Budget Office and others, that we must recognize that 2020 saw a lot of reprioritization in the budget. So, for instance, one of the things was a large cut in 2020 to conditional grants. And some of that money was shifted into an extraordinary payment into the local equitable share. So the 2020 equitable share for local government had 20 billion added into it. So when we look forward and we see what is the growth rate, it's best to take that 20 billion out of our calculation. And this applies to many different parts of expenditure that we're looking at. That 2020 is a very unusual year. A lot of extraordinary things happened in the budget, which is why it's sometimes useful to look at 2019 and say how is the local equitable share growing relative to 2019, for instance. And if we do that, you will see that it's still not growing very rapidly, but it's growing much faster than most other elements of the division of revenue. And I think really we've reached a stage, and it maybe relates to the comments I was making about retrogression, where the issue is not the division of the pie between provinces and national and local, or the division of the pie between local governments or between provincial governments. The problem is the size of the pie. The pie itself is shrinking. And if we continue down this path of the overall pie shrinking, there's very little that the formula can do to prevent the rise of what Honourable Member calls unfunded mandates. But we must also remember that those unfunded mandates don't only apply at a local level. The biggest contraction that we are seeing in expenditure over the medium term is to the criminal justice system and the defense force. And so even there, you will have an unfunded mandate in the sense that there will be a rising demand from South Africans for better policing and effectiveness of a criminal justice system. But the resources available to that system are going to be falling. So when you have a shrinking pie, approaching it as a zero-sum game is not that helpful. Chair, I'm tempted to just carry on until you tell me to stop, but I don't know if that's the best policy.
Yes, actually your time is up, but I didn't hear the last thing only that you need to respond to on the statement that the budget does not really present itself within the framework of the Constitution, and what do you propose moving forward?
Well, I think, as I said, it may be that economic conditions are so bad. If our per capita income continues to decline, it may be that we are unable to sustain the promise of the Constitution. The issue that I'm raising is that government has an obligation to address this issue when it presents a budget, because this is the first time I think that we have presented before us a budget which sees significant reduction in allocations to these core services that are set out in the Bill of Rights: education, basic education, healthcare, and social grants. Those are rights set out in the Constitution. And if government is presenting a budget that envisages an erosion of the budgets in those sectors in particular, it has an obligation to explain and to demonstrate how it has applied it. How it's applied its mind to this question. If it's come to the conclusion that there's no other way forward and that this is it's impossible to proceed without reducing, without retrogressing on these rights, then it must explain to the country openly. On the other hand, it may be that there are issues of choice here. So government is choosing to continue to allocate resources, for instance, to state-owned companies that are performing poorly, whereas they, so is it a question of the economic trajectory or is it a choice that's being made? Government is choosing to reduce taxes, effective tax rates, instead of supporting these rights. So we don't have a solution to the problem. We're simply raising an issue of accountability, that government is accountable to the Constitution. And when it presents a budget that envisages a retrogression of social and economic rights, it has a duty to explain its thinking in rational terms so that we can discuss the issue properly.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Sek. Honorable Joe. Honorable Joe.
Okay, thanks, Comrade Kaiso. Thanks very much from the TAISO for co-chairing the meeting. Thanks to the colleague from both the NA and the NCOP. I would also want to thank the team from PBO and FFC for comprehensive presentations. They are quite helpful to us as members to analyze and understand the budget. And then they will go a long way in assisting us in compiling the report for presentation to the NA and also for public hearings that start tomorrow. So thanks very much to be on NFFC. Unless there are announcements, I would like to close the meeting. Secretariat, is there an announcement except that tomorrow we are meeting at 9 o'clock for public hearings?
No additional
Okay. The only announcement is that members, we are meeting again tomorrow, 9 o'clock, for public hearings on a fiscal framework. Thanks very much. The meeting is adjourned until we meet again tomorrow.